day number five of Sundance Film Festival 2014. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the Sundance Reel. Joining me today as my co-host, I have Jill Orschel. Good morning to you, Jill.
Leslie, how you doing?
Doing great, thanks. So let's talk a little bit about some of the films you've seen and liked.
Oh, well, I've seen a few that I liked, especially last night. There was a live documentary by Sam Green. He's been here a couple times. but last night, he's here with a live documentary called The Measure of All Things. It actually plays tonight at the Yarrow at 9:45. And it is... The footage that he has is of the Guinness Book of World Records, all these different little profiles. And then he does a live narration, which is really kind of dynamic. And, he kind of responds to the audience's responses. And he has musicians in there, about eight of them, playing music. And it is really incredible. And I went with a couple friends. And... I think it's really worthwhile one to go to. It's really special because it's like a one-time deal.
Okay. Now, I thought it played last night, 9:45.
Played last night, and it's again tonight.
Okay.
Actually, I think it's 9:30 at the Yarrow.
All right.
Yeah. And, I think people can do the E-list. I'm hearing great things about the E-list. Are you?
I haven't heard one way or the other. No.
A lot of people are getting in. I think it's a system that's working. So if anybody out there hasn't registered for the E-list, just go right to the sundance.org website and register for the e-wait list.
And I've already seen empty seats, so I know that there's seats available.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. I feel this year it's a relatively, you can get into things. So I really encourage people to get out. Something else that I saw that I love, and man, this woman is a filmmaker dynamo, Lucy Walker. She was here last year with The Crash Reel, and before that, Wasteland, and... she's here with a short documentary called The Lion's Mouth Opens. And boy, she keeps getting more and more sophisticated in her documentary craft. And I was lucky enough to sit with her for her screening. And she's so cute. She's really nervous. But that's in Short Doc, the Short Doc One program. And I think there's a couple more of those available to see. And that's just a great program. But just a chance to see her new work. What else did I like? I know ones that I'm really looking forward to seeing. It's Ping Pong Summer and Land Ho in the next program. You saw Land Ho, right?
I saw Ping Pong Summer that I liked.
Oh, yeah. That next program, that seems to be just so refreshing and new talent. And I think that's a really good program for people to try to see.
Yeah. What about some of the other docs that you've liked?
I'm a little biased with one of our interviews coming up here this morning, and that's The Overnighters. It's a cinema verite, and as a documentary filmmaker myself, it is, I just bow down to the director for sticking with this guy and building the trust that he has with the film subject. It's about a pastor in North Dakota who takes in these different men to work in the oil fields. And the trust that he established with him, the guy is so open with him. It's amazing, just to the very end. It is, I really think it's going to be a movie that wins some awards here this week. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, we'll bring Jesse Moss in. He is the director of The Overnighters. Also, stay tuned. We've got the directors and producers of The Case Against Eight. We've got Peter Sadler. He's director of Camp X-Ray, and also be talking with the director of the film Private Violence, Cynthia Hall. So stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
Hey, Dave, when is the best time for a story?
Sunday mornings at 8:30.
Hi, this is Kathy.
And I'm Dave. We're co-hosts of The Story Mine. Tune in Sunday mornings right here at KPCW.
Experience the treasures of storytelling every Sunday morning at 8:30.
And this is the Sundance Reel. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. And in the studio with us now, the director of the film The Overnighters, Jesse Moss. It's one of the films in the U.S. documentary competition. Good morning to you, Jess. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So Jill gave us just a brief overview, but let's hear it from you in terms of what The Overnighters is. When I originally read about it in the program, it was actually a lot different than what I thought I was going to see.
Yeah. So it's there's an enormous oil boom in North Dakota, of course, and thousands of Americans are streaming up there to find work, high-wage, living-wage jobs. The problem is there's nowhere to live. These are little agricultural towns that weren't prepared for the influx of Americans who are coming. And the film is about a Lutheran pastor in the boom town of Williston who opens his doors to take in these men who have no place to sleep. And gradually he becomes more and more involved in their lives to the point where it takes over his life.
Yeah. So how did you find Pastor Reinke? Is it Reinke?
Yeah, Pastor J. Reinke. I was fascinated that in modern day America was this Wild West frontier town. And I just thought, you know, that's extraordinary. And I wonder what life is like up there. And I was reading the local paper online, and I read a clergy column that Pastor Jay published in which he said, let's not fear the newcomers, let's welcome them. And that was an unusual sentiment because there's been, a lot of fear. A woman was murdered in the town of, or near the town of Williston by some of these guys who'd come into work. And the changes in the town have really transformed life for locals who've kind of got used to living in a place where things didn't change. And so that fear has really pervaded the community. And Pastor Jay, his message was like, let's integrate these people into this community. But that's a lot harder in practice than to preach. And so the film is really about what happens when he tries to live out that that promise to love his neighbor, these men.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big theme of it, trying to do the Christian thing, and yet his congregation, a wall against it.
That's right. So, I mean, I wasn't prepared for the conflict that would ensue based on this choice, because on some level it seems perfectly natural that you see someone in need, you help them. When those men in need number 1,000, many of them have criminal records, it becomes a problem. And the church itself did split, and it was fascinating to come to a church that was engaged in this really profound conversation about what it means to live out the Christian ethic. And I come as a secular person, and that was just fascinating to me, and really to see the pastor bear the burdens of that struggle very personally in his life.
Yeah. Well, and what Jill really liked about it, she can talk more, was just the fact that you were able to get this guy to trust you. I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit about how you did that.
So, yeah, it's a very intimate and emotional film, a story about this pastor who really carries us on this journey. And I made the film by myself. I shot it, in North Dakota by myself. There was no crew. It was just me. And for the first 6 months that I was making the film, I slept in the church with the men, really out of necessity, because all of the hotel rooms in Williston are booked by oil companies. So there was nowhere for me to stay. And I asked the pastor, he said, yeah, you can sleep here. And I did. And that was really the bedrock of the film, that building that relationship of trust and intimacy and really coming to understand what he was up against. And I think when the film took unexpected turns and went to very personal and intimate places in his life, I think because we really built a relationship and I was there by myself without a crew, to distract me or him, I think we were able to go on that journey together, and that was extraordinary.
I thought it was amazing in the film that kind of the umbrella over it was this idea of the oil drilling, and only one time was it referenced to, and that was when one of the people in the church kind of confronted the pastor. And she said, well, you know, I disagree with what's going on, because what's going on with our land? And we all in the audience were like, oh, yes, that is a real issue here.
Absolutely. And I know Utah's been having that conversation, too. I read a really interesting series in the local paper about the prospect of further energy extraction in Utah. And I think in some ways, you know, Williston might seem like an anomaly, this boom town. But I think a lot of small towns sit on top of natural resources in America are going to find themselves with a huge influx of Americans who now, you know, what happens now in America is I think more and more people need to move to work. And that means they leave their families, they leave their communities. And that was one of the conversations that really inspired the film for me, was a sense that when we talk about energy and oil and drilling and fracking, you know, we do talk a lot about the environmental consequences. But I wanted to look at what the human labor side of that story was. And I felt like that was at least missing for me in the conversation. Like, what is the price that individuals and families and communities pay when oil comes to town?
So what about the it's not just one oil company, then there's several. I mean, where's their responsibility in this?
That's a really good question. And I mean, these are some of the biggest companies in the world. We're talking about Halliburton, Schlumberger, extraordinarily profitable companies that move into these little towns and take over the Leviathan, if you will, of oil. Mm-hmm. And their position is they pay huge royalties to the state of North Dakota, which is flush with cash. And they house their workers. So they say, we pay taxes or we pay royalties. That's the state of North Dakota's problem. Problem is, the state of North Dakota cannot keep up with a change, a huge change in infrastructure and housing and law enforcement and healthcare and education. And just, I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of people who are pouring into this small state. But the oil companies don't, I don't think social responsibility in that way enters into their calculations. And it's a mercenary enterprise. And it's, I think that's the other thing that's extraordinary about Williston is kind of raw capitalism. And it makes for compelling watching, but you can see the casualties.
Well, and that's why I was surprised, because you do show some scenes, you know, before the city council, you know, they're talking about banning campers and RVs. And, yeah. And of course, then they deny his request for a conditional use permit to allow people to stay the night. But what they don't do is get proactive about it. And, you know, I mean, I didn't see any of the entrepreneurial spirit about somebody building a campground or, you know, even asking to
fix
the problem.
You would think that responsible civic leaders could find a solution. And it is a conservative community, and perhaps in some other communities in more progressive states, they would find another solution. No other churches helped. No other organizations helped. This was one man who looked around and said, I'm going to act. And right now, the city of Williston has convened a committee to look at the problem. As we all know, that's probably a recipe for inaction. I think it takes moral courage to stand up, and particularly in the face of fear, to stand up and say, I'm going to do what's right. And, you know, they did shut him down. They shut down the program, and it was really a tragedy. And I think a lot about the men who are up there, and women too. I mean, there are some women who come up, and couples, sleeping in their cars, sleeping in the, you know, anywhere they can find, on the ground. And for 2 years, there was a warm place for these men. Hmm. And now there isn't.
Yeah. And this is your second feature-length documentary here at Sundance.
First as a director. So I did produce a film about 5 years ago called William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. But I got to say, it's really different to be here with my own work as a director. Frankly, it's a lot better. Scarier, though.
Yeah. In what way?
You know, I feel, the film has been a huge risk personally, creatively, professionally. And you know, it's very hard to find support for the movie along the way. It was, I guess, many times with observational documentaries where you don't know how they're going to end, it's hard to persuade a funder to get behind them. Like, you don't know what the story is. And you guys know the story goes to some really unexpected places. And in fact, I didn't shoot the ending of the film till late September, 2 weeks before I sent the film to Sundance. So it's been a sprint. But it's scary to put that personal work and risk up on screen. But I feel like this is the best place to do that, because audiences are hungry for that, those journeys and those conversations, which are, they're scary for them, for me. And, you know, I have my film subject, Pastor Jay, is here. So, now he's Jay, no longer Pastor. Hope that's not a spoiler, but.
Yeah.
So what is the status now, though, of the town? I mean, are people still flocking? And
yeah. So the boom is unrelenting, and people are still pouring into Williston. Wages are still high. Housing is still scarce. It continues to be the strongest economy in the United States, the biggest job growth. So it remains the place to go in America to find a job. And there are jobs. I mean, it is not a mirage. Now, what's a mirage for many people is the high-wage, super high-wage rig job. And that's like the gold strike of 1849, where you think it's what draws you out. And that's, I think, something that the film explores, is like the reality for most of these men is really different. They don't walk into those jobs. They fight and they struggle. And then when you do find a $15, $20 an hour job, you can't find a place to live, or you can't. The cost of living is like Manhattan and San Francisco. So that's what's challenging.
Again, The Overnighters is one of the films in the U.S. documentary competition. It's directed by Jesse Moss. Great job. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club and sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is Park City's in-town private country club, just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Jill Orschel and introducing you to the directors and producers of the film The Case Against Eight. Again, one of those in the U.S. documentary competition. I have Ben Cotner and Ryan White in the studio with us. Good morning.
Thanks for having us, Leslie.
Thank you.
So in 2010, Sundance programmed the film Eight, The Mormon Proposition. It was an indictment of the Mormon Church's involvement in the promotion and eventual passage of California's Prop 8. Your film now then follows the legal challenge to that once the proposition was...
Kind of picks up where that film left off. So our film begins with the passage of Proposition 8 and then follows the two plaintiffs that sued the government of California in the federal courts and then the two all-star lawyers who were the opposing attorneys during Bush v. Gore and everyone thought to be enemies in the courtroom, and they actually joined forces for this case, Ted Olson and David Boies.
And I love those guys only because it was like they became kind of a third couple in the whole screening.
Well, it's great for us. We were just talking about how, you know, the couples are billed as ordinary people, but we find them far from ordinary. And the lawyers are billed as these superstars, larger than life. But they're great ordinary people, too. And it's really great that we were able to share the personal side of their lives as well.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit more about Ted, because there were some great scenes in the film talking about, it's like, are we on the right side? If Ted's on our side? Yeah.
Yeah, people were very wary of Ted Olson taking on LGBT rights. He was Bush's Solicitor General. He won Bush v. Gore. I think he's one of the winningest lawyers ever in front of the Supreme Court, and almost all of those are extremely conservative cases. So LGBT leaders, understandably, probably were very wary when he joined the case. On the flip side, conservatives were also very wary of why he was doing this. And so it was kind of one of those situations where everyone was unhappy except for the lawsuit. And so there was a lot of hearts and minds that had to be changed over the course of the last 5 years. You know, I don't want to ruin the ending, but Ted Olson is the best arguer in front of the Supreme Court. So I think in the end, everyone's on board that he might have been the best attorney to do this. So, but it took a long time for people to come around.
Yeah. And I heard a couple of references to this being called a love story. And I think I would agree with that, especially because of just the last few minutes of the film where you show a couple of wedding scenes. And it was just so touching.
Thank you. You know, that was really important for us to we had this framework of this great legal argument, but we wanted to show the human side of it. And Paul and Jeff and Chris and Sandy are the two couples that are in the film. And I think after you see everything that they've gone through to get to that wedding, it really is an emotional payoff because you just you see the hardship that they've gone through. And to see that love manifested in the ceremonies in the end was something for us. We were so excited to be there, and we're so excited to have it in the film.
Well, they talk about just the vetting process to get these four plaintiffs. I mean, yeah, wouldn't every filmmaker love to have that vetting process take place?
Well, I thought it was amazing. There was no cameras allowed in the actual courtroom, so you guys decided to follow the team of lawyers and the plaintiffs practicing. I thought that was such a great idea, and it helped have this building effect of like, okay, almost like a team getting ready for the big game.
Yeah, there were, so originally there were supposed to be cameras in the courtroom, and the Supreme Court ended up blocking that the very last second. And so the moment that that happened, Ben and I were making a movie regardless, but the moment that that happened, we felt an increased motivation and almost a burden that our film was now going to be the only way that the American public would have access to this trial. So we really tried hard in the editing room with our amazing editor, Kate Amend, to make people feel as if they were in that courtroom with you, since they didn't get to see footage of it. And so if you see our film, you'll see that the plaintiff testimonies, which were probably the most emotional part of the trial itself, when all four plaintiffs had to go on their stand and put their life in the court system and tell their stories, we try to make the audience feel as if they're in there, and hopefully we succeeded in that.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a great way to structure the film.
Thanks.
Yeah,
yeah. You still, we do see scenes of the other side, I will, but you really didn't show a lot of that. How come?
Sure. We, our initial access to this case was through the American Foundation for Equal Rights, which is the organization that started the lawsuit. And we really started following them, and we wanted this to be a character piece of their journey and the process of taking a case to the Supreme Court. Our movie, we didn't want to be about gay marriage. We didn't want it to be about whether gay marriage is right or wrong. We wanted it to be about their these characters and their journey, and we had never seen a film that followed a case to the Supreme Court, so we thought that would be a really interesting window into the American judicial system.
Yeah, but why not show more of, the attorney,
sure,
Cooper
sure,
and his case?
Yeah.
And I think, as you explained last night, that it was you really then risk the trust that you had built up with the plaintiffs.
Exactly. I think it really would have compromised our access to the side that we were following. As well as, ethically, it would be a little bit questionable if we were inside two confidential teams, mm-hmm, at the same time. So even if they had allowed us to follow them, which I'm not sure they would have, I don't think that was our goal.
And it was an evidence-based trial. It was a total curveball that this case was thrown into trial, right? And so both sides had to bring in expert witnesses. They had to have a testimony. The other side, the Yes on 8 campaign, only brought in two expert witnesses. One of them testified on more of a technicality than their main witness was David Blankenhorn, and he actually is in our film. So if you're looking at it from an evidence standpoint, we have a main interview. He's a main character in our film, basically their prime expert, and we're so glad that he was willing to participate with us and be in the film.
And it was also really important to us not to demonize the other side. This really wasn't about saying they were bad people. They had an amazingly talented team of lawyers working on their case as well. So I for one would love to see a film about their side. So, I'm not sure if anybody was filming it, but that would be a really cool movie to see.
Yeah, so it was like five years in the process. I think you said you had some 600 hours of footage.
Yes.
So were you there for every meeting? I mean, or did you miss key discovery or something? At those meetings and just think, oh, we've been to every other one, but this one?
I can't think of one moment where we weren't there. I mean, we were very good at covering for each other. We also had a third camera person. We never had cinematographers or sound people because it was so sensitive that Ben and I and Rebecca, our other camera person, got access. And they knew our faces. Then they started to get to know us. And so we were allowed into all of these things that, a random cinematographer or sound man would not have been allowed to. So the three of us tried really hard to cover for each other. And, at the drop of a dime, you had to be in a random city, fly to D.C., fly to San Francisco, because the court system is so unpredictable. You don't know when anything's going to happen. But I can't think of one moment that I'm disappointed that we didn't get.
There were a few times where there were some, court-protected documents that we wouldn't be allowed in the room while they were discussing those. And the lawyers were very sensitive about those court orders. But those wouldn't have been the exciting meetings, I don't think, anyway. So these, moot courts where Ted Olson would practice his arguments, which I think every lawyer dreams of watching Ted Olson doing this practice, that was really an honor for him to allow us to film those scenes.
And one of the plaintiffs described you as just two more kids. We've got enough around here already. Did you feel like that?
We do. Yeah, they call us their fifth and sixth son. They have four. So, I mean, that's part of the fun of documentary filmmaking, is getting close with people like that and winning over their trust and telling their story in a way that they're happy with now. And Chris and Sandy are like our moms, and we're just so proud that they're proud of the film to share with their boys and hopefully their grandkids one day.
Yeah. And in the meantime, you had lives to live and jobs to go to. And I think somebody finished a couple of films in the meantime, too.
Yeah,
Ryan?
I mean, yeah, I'm a documentary filmmaker, so it's been 5 years, and it's difficult when you're a documentary filmmaker and trying to pay the bills to know that you might not have a film coming out for 5 or 6 years. So I made two other films while we were doing this, and Ben had a very demanding full-time job as an acquisitions executive, and so it was a balance of trying to keep our other work lives and also always be available, because I think at the end of the day, this was our baby, both of ours. And so we were willing to sacrifice whatever it took to film events for this film or finish this film.
Yeah. Did you learn anything particular about our justice system?
Absolutely. We joke that we all got honorary law degrees after spending 5 years
for
with
better
these
or
guys,
worse.
For
yeah.
better or for worse. And we learned a lot about the law. We learned a lot about, you know, the institution of marriage. I think when you we're lucky enough to be in the courtroom every day and watch the witnesses, the expert witnesses, and the plaintiff's testimonies. And I think we learned a lot about ourselves. And what it means to be married and to be in love. I think that's something that the film really addresses, and we were excited to learn about that.
So we see this happening now in Utah. Is this going to be a similar process then for every state that has basically banned same-sex marriage?
It could be. I mean, it's unknown right now, but it's if you think about the timeline, right? The case that we followed was filed in May of 2009. Chris and Sandy and Paul and Jeff won in trial in August 2010. They didn't get married until June 2013. So they were put through this 5-year process of limbo. Utah couples are going through the exact same thing right now. Exactly. Not to mention the states where it's never even been legalized, even for a couple week window. And so that to me is something that I hope people take away from our film, whatever side you're on, to watch these people's stories and ask if that's right to put these people in limbo, to put their families in limbo. I mean, people pass away unmarried, you know, people's parents pass away and never see them get married. And we have who knows how many couples nationwide who are going through that. And so I hope people at least ask that, whether that's right that we put these people through this process.
Yeah. And there are currently over 30 cases that have been filed in different states challenging bans on same-sex marriage. So
Based on the
DOMA and the Perry decision. So they really did give birth to this whole crop of new cases, which one or many of them will eventually make it to the Supreme Court. So we hope that people will have a chance to see this film as a part of that conversation so that they can understand some of the things that went into it.
Yeah, it was a real education for me watching it. I'd love to see Utah audiences see it and across the United States.
And I think that that's what it came down to, was kind of this essence of who's harmed here, right? I mean, where we have same-sex marriages, those who don't agree with it can't prove any, you know, that they're being harmed by any of that by that decision. And I think the film touches on that.
It's a big moment in our film, actually, because before the trial started, Judge Walker had a preliminary hearing, and he asked the head lawyer for the other side, the Yes on 8 side, what harm would be done. And his answer was, I don't know. And it became this huge blow-up moment that I think he regrets greatly, because the press picked up on it. You know, the Ted and David picked up on it, and it's been repeated over and over. But that was the answer in the courtroom, and I don't know if any evidence has ever been brought in that shows who's harmed.
And that's when basically the Supreme Court's ruling that there is no legal standing because there's no
exactly
harm
because
done?
Because the governor and the attorney general weren't willing to defend the law. This group of people who were the proponents of Proposition, and they actually put it on the ballot, they stepped in to defend the law. And so there was a lot of question of whether they actually had standing, because they weren't officially representing the state of California. And on top of that, they couldn't prove any tangible harms. So the Supreme Court ultimately found that there were no harms to these people, and therefore they didn't have the standing to be there at the Supreme Court.
So HBO's got the film already. Yeah.
HBO's got it.
Mm-hmm. That great. So,
so
you had sold it before you even got here then, huh?
We did. We made the film for 4 years on our own. You know, like, as a filmmaker, it's a dream to get into Sundance, and it's a dream to work with Sheila Evans and HBO, and we pulled off both those things after this film, so we're so thrilled. HBO will be airing it in June, which is obviously completely exciting. They're putting a lot of resources into it. We're very lucky. And so they're very engaged in also getting this out to the country, starting a dialogue, and so we're so excited to partner with them.
And you're thinking, what, in 5 years that this is going to be history, this whole issue of?
Well, Chad Griffin at the HRC, shortly after the Supreme Court's decision, made the goal of 50 states in 5 years. And at the rate that it's been going in the last year, it seems like that might be an achievable goal, if not even sooner. So I think that's an exciting time.
Well, the case against eight, I've got director and producers Ben Cotter and Ryan White. It's part of the U.S. documentary competition. Thanks for stopping by this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's 9:36.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage services provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more, currently nearly 6 million pounds per year. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, and in the studio with us now, I have the director of Peter Sattler of the film Camp X-Ray, part of the U.S. Dramatic Competition. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So congratulations. My understanding is it's your first feature film making it to Sundance.
It is, yeah. Thank you. I'm very pleasantly surprised, very happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about it. I don't know that when I see the title, it just doesn't make sense to me when I read about the description.
Yeah, so the movie is about a female guard played by Kristen Stewart who joins the military looking to do something important with her life and then ends up stationed at Guantanamo Bay where, of course, the mission is really far from black and white. And while she's down there, she encounters and has to deal with these detainees on a day-to-day basis. They spend a lot of time interacting with each other, and through that interactions, she starts to take notice of and develop this very kind of strange relationship with one of the detainees in particular, a character named Ali, who's played by a fabulous Iranian actor named Peyman Mahdi, which if you've ever seen the Academy Award-winning Iranian film, A Separation, he was the star of that, and he's a fabulous actor. And so the movie really the movie is not really a message movie at all. I kind of wanted to do something different and say, what if we did a movie at Guantanamo Bay that focused solely on the experience of the characters and didn't try and beat you over the head and really preach to you about what needs to be done down there, and really just tried to focus on these characters. And that's really what it's about, is the relationship between this character that Kristen is playing and the character that Peyman is playing.
Yeah. So what does Camp X-Ray refer to, though? I mean, is it a place then?
Yeah.
Like Camp David? Or?
Well, it's actually interesting. So when they first started bringing detainees to Guantanamo, they built these two very temporary camps. One was called Camp Iguana, and one was called Camp X-Ray. So it does refer to one of the names of one of the camps. Now, our movie actually, and we show a little bit of that in the beginning of our film, but our movie doesn't actually take place in Camp X-Ray. It takes place years later, because now those two camps are both closed now, and they've been replaced by an elaborate kind of maximum security prison that's been built down there. Yeah, which is largely called Camp Delta. There's a bunch of other different camps. But our movie takes place not immediately in the beginning when things were kind of crazy and hectic, but ours takes place 8 or 10 years later, because I really wanted to focus on the aftermath of that and the idea of not at the beginning when there was torture and crazy stuff going on and it was kind of the Wild West, but really what's going on more right now where these people are still kind of stuck down there. The soldiers are still stuck down there, and they're just kind of in this limbo where they just have to find a way to get through the day-to-day of it all.
Hmm. Now, you had to build sets then for this? Because I don't imagine you could, just go to Guantanamo Bay, right?
No, yeah. Well, we it's not the easiest place to go shoot a movie at. No, we actually did not shoot in Guantanamo Bay at all, obviously. But we got very fortunate. In my research, I learned that, as I just mentioned, when the Army needed a permanent detention facility down there, they turned to just a prison contractor, a U.S. prison contractor, and said, hey, build us a prison down here. And so the facilities in Guantanamo Bay look almost exactly like any federal security, maximum security prison you'd find in the States, which was great for us because that meant all we had to do was find a prison we could shoot in, which is also a very hard thing to do. But we were very lucky in that there is an abandoned juvenile detention facility outside of Los Angeles that has a maximum security wing And so we were and the bones of it look exactly like Guantanamo Bay. So all we had to do was really go in and add that extra layer, which again was no small task in and of itself. But we had the base of it already there for us, which was a huge get for us.
Well, I thought Kristen Stewart sure did do an amazing performance. How did you get her attached to the film as well as your other actor?
Yeah, thank you. I think she's absolutely amazing in the film. And it's a very difficult role, too. You know, it's a very because her character is very reserved and very, you know, in that she is a soldier, you know, she keeps this kind of tough demeanor on the whole time. And so it's very hard to do that, but still kind of convey this kind of bubbling, you know, emotion underneath. I wish there was an amazing story about how we got Kristen, but it was honestly just as simple as we sent her agent the script and he loved it and sent it on to her and she said yes and we were off to the races. It was just this – honestly, it was a Hail Mary. At the beginning, you know, I'd intended to make this a very small little weird Gitmo movie and this kind of – I wanted to do this strange apolitical Gitmo movie just about characters. And we took a Hail Mary at Kristen as the first and only person we went to. And she loved it, and she was really into it. She really loved the character and everything, and she loves doing kind of smaller, interesting, weird little movies like this. And she was an amazing collaborator throughout the whole process. So, yeah, I couldn't have been more fortunate.
Yeah, so she understands it's an independent film and doesn't command the vampire prices.
That was so amazing. Like I got the call. It's like, are you sitting down? Because Kristen Stewart wants to be in your movie. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. We should probably meet though first because like I want to make sure that she understands exactly what she's signing on for because this is going to be a very DIY affair. And from the beginning, she totally understood that. And I think she really likes I've talked to her about it. And she likes both. She likes big movies. She likes small movies. But I think that you know, she gets something different from each. And I think she likes the kind of small camaraderie of a film like this where everybody knows everybody. I mean, she knew the names of all the PAs and they all knew her. And so there's a real kind of esprit de corps there that I think she likes. And also on a movie like this where there's not as many voices in the room, there's a lot more room to play and create and for her to have a voice in this role, which is absolutely essential, you know. And so the movie really was a true collaboration between me, Kristen, and Payman Mahdi. And I think she really enjoyed it. And yeah, she was a joy to work with. She is like the least diva person you'll ever meet on earth. I mean, she's just the most down-to-earth person.
Yeah. So are there female prisoners at Gitmo? I mean, they just have female guards. I was surprised when I
Yeah, there's actually there's a lot of female guards down there because if you're a woman and want to go in the military, you can't go into like the front line. You can't go into infantry. So they get funneled out to something like the military police, which is what you can do, unless you end up going into some of the more support staff type of areas. But if you actually want to see some action or something, the military police is the only way to go. And in the research that I did, there's quite a few women that are actually guards down there, which I found very interesting. In terms of female detainees, I feel there aren't – I don't think there's hardly any at all. There might be like one or two. I'll have to double-check my research, but I don't remember that being the case at all. Even weirder, though, is that they had a couple of kids down there. They had a couple like – I want to say like 15 or 14 or something like that. They had like a few of them as well. I have to double-check my research, but I know – remember that at one point they had – a couple kids down there, which is just a very strange situation.
I thought it was really interesting. It was a reference to really early on in your movie that they don't call them prisoners. They call them detainees for a very important reason.
Right. The reason they do that is because, and Kristen's character points this out, is that prisoners are subject to the rules of the Geneva Convention. Detainees are not. And it's, there's so many weird, interesting details like that about Gitmo. And so that was kind of a big challenge as to, like, how do we convey some of these interesting facts without just turning the movie into complete exposition? But there's a lot of interesting kind of, and again, it goes back to the whole thing, you know, that place is just kind of this weird limbo. And I think that's part of the reason they put it in Cuba anyway, because it's neither American soil nor Cuban soil. So it's like kind of a perfect place to just be in the middle in this kind of shades of gray world.
And there's also one other thing. I don't know if it gives it away, but where the detainee was from, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. In the movie, he kind of this character surprises Kristen's character by saying, it's funny, she's like, oh, yeah, this thing's probably banned where you're from. And he's like, what do you mean, in Germany? And she's like, wait, you're from Germany? And, you know, I started doing research on some of the detainees and things down there. Yes, a lot of them are from the Middle East, but there's a lot of people that were originally from somewhere else or were in the middle of Pakistan or somewhere else. And so in terms of creating this character of Ali that Payman played, I wanted to try and turn on its head the idea of what you might think the traditional detainee is down there. And so we wanted to make a character that was very intelligent. You know, he reads a lot of books as a whole thing in the movie, and just kind of in a way is surprising, because that's part of the character of Cole's journey through this world. Is you go into this place with these expectations that you're going to have a bunch of, you know, raving madmen trying to kill you the whole time. And yes, there is a lot of hostility down there. But at the same time, I wanted to kind of have her open her eyes a little bit and be like, oh, wait a minute. Who are these people down here? This guy's very literate. He's very, you know, verbal. Like, he's from, like, you know, he's European and Middle East. And it's like, who is this guy? He's not just some, like, guy who, you know, raises sheep in the middle of Afghanistan.
And one thing I really loved was the Harry Potter.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. There's, well, actually, it's very true. Like, there's a, you're referencing in the movie, they there's a lot going on about the book cart, because that's a lot of what the guards do. They have to basically service these detainees. You know, they have to give them book carts, they have to give them food, they have to take their laundry. And there's a lot of scenes talking where this character of Ali is asking about and talking about Harry Potter books, which in my research, they're actually very popular down there. It's, and, you know, that kind of absurd contradiction is what I was just talking about. Is, you know, we think of these people like, oh, they're these real bad guys. It's like, no, they're not. They read Harry Potter. They love the Da Vinci Code, you know, and some of the more compliant detainees get to watch movies and things like that. And so that, again, trying to show this different light of things down there, and in some way trying to add a little bit of absurd kind of levity to it as well, is what I really wanted to do, to kind of add, I think, more realism. You know, I think if you're in that situation, it's not just going to be this super intense dramatic situation all the time. There's going to be some kind of quirky, weird moments too.
Yeah, so with Kristen and the star value there, film being shopped around at all?
Yes, we are. It is a, I mean, make no mistake about it, a movie about Guantanamo Bay is a challenging movie to market or sell, which is why it's needed to be done in the independent world, you know, because I don't think any studio would touch a subject matter like this. Even though we approach it the way we do in this kind of, I think, more uplifting way instead of this very kind of, you know, preachy way, it is a challenge always. And that's something we knew from the beginning. And so Kristen's great because she brings a lot of attention to a film that I think a lot of people wouldn't even consider approaching. So yeah, we're doing the dance right now with distributors, yeah.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Peter. Peter Sattler is the director of the film Camp X-Ray, part of the U.S. Dramatic Competition. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's 9:48.
KPCW and the Park City Museum present the weekly series Park City History Bits. Learn a nugget of local history. A new bit debuts every week. Park City History Bits, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Only in Park City, only on KPCW. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Hi, I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Join us for The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
From the science of willpower to exploring the teenage brain.
From bike fit to relationship alignment.
From embracing imperfection to going gluten-free.
Join us for conversations with the experts on health, fitness, and lifestyle.
It's The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa.
Park City Clinic.
Grand Valley Bank.
And Park Meadows Country Club.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com, Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher. In the studio with us now, the director of the film Private Violence, Cynthia Hall. Joining her also is Kit Gruel, who is featured in the film. Good morning, and thanks for joining us, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, the program guide, Cynthia, nails it when it asks, you know, the most common question asked of domestic violence victims is, why didn't you leave? So is that the kind of the question that you try to answer in this film, Private Violence?
Exactly. I think that that's the primary question that most of us ask, and it's completely the wrong question. And so we hope by the end of the film that the audience feels the same. And you know, this is an issue that, you know, even when I started it, I was asking the same question. And spending time with Kit, who's in the film, just watching her work with these women and getting being able to understand this issue more completely just really was a slap in the face for me.
So you met Kit and then decided to make the film? Or
actually, Kit approached me about working on a project that would document the history of the battered women's movement. And so we were on this path collecting interviews and trying to piece together something that was more of a historical documentary. And I just was fascinated with Kit and her work. And so I kept turning the cameras to Kit and filming her. And initially, I even would lie to her, and I would tell her, I'm not really filming you, Kit, you know. But this was a world that I just had never seen before. Watching an advocate interact with a victim in crisis mode, you know, they have been beat down, literally beat down some of the time, and watching how just having that one person come into your life who really cares about you and tells you that you are worth something and how that really can transform this individual. It was amazing. It was just incredible watching that.
Kit, tell us a little bit about your story. Because you're in the field now, but only because of your circumstances, huh?
Right. I survived a very violent marriage that ended with the death of my husband. I did not kill him. He was killed in an accident. But after he died, I left the North Carolina mountains and moved down to the Chapel Hill area and saw an ad to become an advocate for battered women. And so I went through the training. This was back in the mid-'80s. And I just felt like I had found the perfect glove that fit my hand, and it just it's so misunderstood, and there are so many myths and misconceptions about domestic violence. And so as time has gone by, I've been an advocate for a long, long time, but I've also done a lot of community education, which means working with a wide array of people who respond to victims of domestic violence: law enforcement, healthcare providers, clergy. And And about 12 years ago, it occurred to me that even after all these years, I was still hearing the same question, which is, why doesn't she just leave? And I know that documentary film is really one of the best ways to kind of lay aside some of the myths and misconceptions. And I also wanted people to understand about the battered women's movement and what it has meant, because much of the work happens kind of in the shadows. And so so that was kind of one of the things I wanted to do. And I started with a couple of women in California and then ultimately found Cynthia. And she was a little sneaky. but watching the film now, even though, you know, I don't enjoy seeing myself on screen, but I get that this is really going to, I think, provide people with a much more intimate view of the complexity of domestic violence, and understand how we just, as a out of habit, I think, blame women when they're victimized, and that it's time, we're 35, 40 years into this work, it's time to start asking an entirely different set of questions. And it's good timing for us because 2014 is the 20th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act. And so, you know, being here at Sundance and then working with HBO, I think this is going to give us an opportunity to really have a very broad, national discussion about this issue.
Now, if your husband hadn't died, would you still be with him?
No, no, no. I tried to commit suicide 3 weeks before he died. And
so you wouldn't be here?
Yeah. So I'm quite sure, because it was just really bad. So I'm quite sure that if he hadn't died, that he would have killed me before, you know, it wouldn't have been much longer because it had gotten so bad. So it sounds hokey and cliched, but there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about what it means to be free, to be able to go out into the world and interact with people, both men and women, in ways that I feel like I'd like to. And I don't have to worry that I'm going to say something wrong or do something wrong or whatever. And I think it's a kind of freedom that a lot of people take for granted, and they don't realize what it means to be free until they lose it.
Why couldn't you walk out the door and go down to Chapel Hill?
Because he had been in the Marine Corps and had been to Vietnam, and he was trained to hunt people down and kill them, and that's what he told me routinely. He said, there's not a place you can go on the planet to get away from me. I will hunt you down and I will kill you if you ever try to leave. And that's the reality that a lot of battered women face. That, I mean, we just had this case here in Utah last week where This police officer shot and killed his wife, his children, his mother-in-law, and then himself. And separation is a very, very, very dangerous act. It's a revolutionary act, you know, because women are essentially, oftentimes I call restraining orders a declaration of independence. You know, we're not going to live like this anymore. And yet, rather than us embracing battered women and telling them, yes, you don't deserve to be frightened and coerced and terrorized in your own home, what we do is we blame them for it. And so I think that with private violence, we're going to be able to kind of look that right in the eye and say, we need to ask a different set of questions.
I just wanted to mention to the listeners that so this is such a heavy, difficult, complex, just a hard subject to just face. And I wanted to mention to that you guys got a standing ovation at your Sunday premiere. Yeah. And that says a lot about you, Cynthia, of how you have managed to take this subject and make it to present it in a way that people can finally digest it.
Yeah. And it is a difficult subject, and we did struggle with that. And I think that's one reason why I wanted to turn my cameras to Kit and film her, because what I was able to get from that is really a lot of context and this intimacy and access to this world that no one has ever really seen up close unless you've experienced it. But what it also does is it shows that there is hope. So, yes, it's horrible, and there are times when I think that you're watching the film that you want to turn away. But then because of the way that we tell the story and the narrative drive of this one woman, Deanna, her story of trying to seek justice, you're engaged. You want to know what happens, and you're in on this ride with them until the end. You are. You just want to see what happens, and you're so wanting something positive to come out, and something good does happen. And so I think that's the reason why it is accessible and digestible. And then I think that's going to allow us to reach a much wider audience.
So, Kit, instead of asking, you know, why didn't you leave, I mean, what questions should we be asking?
The questions we should be asking is, why do we reflexively blame women when they're beaten up or when they're sexually assaulted? And why do men feel like they've got the right to treat women like they're subordinate and like they're private property? And then the other thing, too, is that I ask people a lot when I go out to do community ed, think about the last time there was a murder or murder-suicide in your community and the TV station rolls up and the reporter gets out and finds the neighbor. And when they ask the neighbor about this person who's just annihilated his family, oftentimes the neighbor says, but he seemed like such a nice guy. And so I think we have to take a hard look at why we continue to cultivate this notion that this nice guy has just annihilated his entire family. And what does that say about us as a society and what we're willing to see and not see and say and not say? And so I think if we start to focus on the way our laws are written to address this crime, how we do or do not focus on it in our criminal justice system with our social workers, then I think we can start to make some of the appropriate changes that need to be made. But as Cynthia said, the good stories don't get reported, because there are a lot of women who do manage to get away and do manage to live lives that are violence-free forever. And for those of us that do advocacy work, it's just a glorious thing to be a part of.
All right. So Private Violence, HBO has already picked it up in Cynthia?
Yes, it's going to be on HBO later in 2014, sometime in the fall. So we're very excited to partner with them on this project.
Well, congratulations on that. And again, it's Private Violence. It's part of the U.S. Documentary Film Competition. Cynthia Hall and Kit Grill, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thanks.
Thanks.
And that's a wrap of the Sundance Reel. This is KPCW Park City. It's 10 o'clock, time for news.